This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Matt Fidler. In today's show, Butte County warns that a spike in COVID infections will keep getting worse unless the community commits to social distancing and face coverings. That's especially true for local college campuses. Plus, we explore the relationship between the U.S. Forest Service and CAL FIRE as both agencies look towards a holiday weekend of super high temperatures and low humidity. That's all ahead. If you have questions or comments, leave them on our message line, 433-9216, or head over to mynspr.org. For Thursday, September 3rd, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. Butte County health authorities warned today that unless people start practicing more social distancing and wearing face coverings, the county will continue to see an alarming increase in COVID infections. Butte County is currently in the so-called purple status, which is the most restrictive tier assigned by the state. County Health Director Danette York said at a news conference earlier today that to move out of that tier, Butte County needs to see less than 7 COVID cases per 100,000 people. Right now, it's at 10.3. NSPR's Andre Bayek spoke with Lisa Almaguer, Communications Manager for Butte County Public Health, about the dramatic increase in cases among college-age people and how the county is responding to outbreaks linked to colleges.
I'd like to start with the health department's announcement this week of a dramatic increase in COVID cases in college-aged people. Can you explain what that increase has been and who has been largely affected?
Sure. So since August 24th, which was the first day of school for both Butte College and for Chico State, we have seen a significant increase in COVID-19 cases in Chico among people ages 18 to 24, especially those living near the CSU Chico campus. And as Labor Day weekend approaches, we get very concerned that we're already seeing increases in this age group and that we know typically a holiday weekend such as this leads to gatherings. And so we are trying to get the word out. We're trying to let the community know what we're seeing. And so just to give you some numbers, the total number of COVID-19 cases in Butte County between the first day of school, so August 24th, and Monday, August 31st, was 557. Of those cases, 464 are from the Chico area. And of those cases, 78% are in Chico, and they're in people ages 18 to 24.
Can the increase in cases in that group, that 18 to 24 group, be pinpointed to students attending, let's say, Chico State or Butte College?
I'm sure not all of them are college students, so we can't confirm that all cases are associated with the universities, but the increase in cases does coincide closely with the start of school and the influx of a large number of college-age students coming to the area. So the age range is right, the location is right, and the time frame is right. So we believe there are many, many cases associated with students.
And can you share the role public health plays when it identifies outbreaks connected to campuses or student living?
A few weeks back, we actually announced that we had an outbreak in a multi-unit complex that was near the university. So we work very closely with, let's just say, an apartment manager. We work very closely with the Chico State health professionals and their administration. So they are aware of the situation and help connect those who are associated with the outbreak for testing, and then make sure that everyone knows how to isolate if they are indeed positive for COVID-19, and for those who are close contacts of those cases to understand how to self-quarantine and monitor themselves for symptoms.
With such a large number of cases being reported, sometimes daily, has the county's capacity to conduct contact tracing been outstripped in some way?
I guess the short answer is yes, in some way. However, with that said, Butte County Public Health will never stop the containment and the contact case investigation and contact tracing. We just might not be able to do that work for every single case moving forward. So to give you an example, the total cases that we announced on Tuesday was 120 cases. That was the second time that we had had that many cases in one day. one person who's positive for COVID-19 typically has 7 to 10 close contacts. So that would equal 1,200 people to contact for one day of cases, and possibly even more if those are college students. College students have roommates, and sometimes they have fraternity or sorority affiliations. They might work someplace. They have classmates. They have significant others, and they tend to move around and to gather more. And so if those contacts could be even more than the 1,200 that I just stated. And that is too many to contact in one day for that amount of cases.
With Chico State's announcement that it is shutting down its dorms, what is public health's understanding about the possible measures the school is taking to quarantine potentially infectious people that have been sent home?
I never like to speak for another organization, but I do know that public health has had quite a few conversations with Chico State. And my understanding is that Chico State will accommodate any student in the university owned housing if they've been tested positive or have been evaluated as being exposed to someone with COVID-19. They are working hard to keep COVID-19 positive and possibly infected individuals from impacting the community. And just keep in mind, just because a student lives on campus doesn't mean they're not already part of the community. They are part of the community. They just happen to live on campus. So the fact that a student may move off campus doesn't mean that now all of a sudden they're in the community. They're already a community member. Just because they live on campus doesn't change that. So Chico State's going to make sure that anyone who's positive can remain safely isolated, and that those who are close contacts can remain safely quarantined until they are needing to move out.
The public health department has been stressing guidance regarding gatherings this week, in some ways looking forward to Labor Day weekend, but just because of the increase in cases locally. What is that guidance from the department?
The guidance actually comes from the state health officer, and that everyone must comply with state orders to avoid gatherings and parties with anyone outside of your immediate household. It's not a suggestion. It's not a recommendation. It's a requirement. And when you gather with people that are outside of your household, even if they're close friends or family, you risk exposing those around you, your friends, your family, your significant others, your coworkers. And that's going to keep us in this place that we don't want to be in, this most restrictive tier of the new state's metric system. And we're not going to make progress. We're not going to be able to go out and dine inside of the restaurants we want to go to. We're not going to be able to go to a bar or have a barbecue or a potluck with anyone until we can get our cases under control.
It's my understanding that public health has been in discussions with law enforcement to potentially crack down on parties or other gatherings. Can you share a little bit about how those discussions are going?
It's my understanding that enforcement conversations are happening between the county and other agencies, including law enforcement. Unfortunately, I don't have details to share at this time, but it is something that everyone is looking at, because we know that more is needed at this time to curb the amount of gatherings that are happening in our community. We all need to continue to do better, specifically college-age students ages 18 to 24. People in this age group aren't taking the risk of getting COVID-19 seriously, and they don't think that they will get COVID at all. And if they do, they don't think that they'll get very sick. And what I can tell you is some of the people in this age group that are positive, they are experiencing symptoms. They are sick. Not everyone has extreme symptoms, but some people do, and some people in this age group are experiencing those symptoms.
That was Butte County Public Health Spokeswoman Lisa Almaguer. Firefighters appear to be gaining the upper hand against most of the major wildfires burning across inland Northern California. A short break from erratic dry winds and extreme heat allowed the more than 10,000 firefighters working various blazes to strengthen fire breaks and better contain the flames. But that respite from challenging weather is about to come to a close, with more high temperatures and low humidity on tap for the weekend. NSBR's Mark Albert spoke earlier this week with Jason Nedlow, Public Information Officer for the U.S. Forest Service, about how the agency works with CAL FIRE and how firefighting is going this season.
Jason, the U.S. Forest Service firefighting and CAL FIRE are two distinct organizations, fighting fires generally in different areas. CAL FIRE, while primarily rural, tends to be in more populated areas. Is there a difference in the mission or kind of the philosophy between CAL FIRE and the Forest Service?
Big picture, no. Both of our missions are to protect firefighters and the public and keep them safe from wildfire. Our missions have moved a little closer together just because there are so many structures now within the wild-urban interface, which are right next to the national forest. But I would say that, you know, from CAL FIRE's point of view, you know, they tend to deal with more populated areas when they're fighting wildfire. We deal with some populated areas, but we also have a number of fires that are out in the woods or even in the wilderness. So there's some differences there, but the overall objective for both agencies is to protect life and property from wildfire.
On Monday, firefighters retreated a bit on the west side of the fire, but on the south side, things were looking stronger, the containment line looking better, and allowing the Forest Service to reposition some resources to the north. What are things looking like today on Tuesday and looking forward into the rest of the week with winds shifting direction and upcoming hot temperatures expected?
Yeah, so the winds we had yesterday, which is continuing through today, that provides a challenge. Wind and topography are the two main drivers of wildfire. So, today is, making sure lines are secure, using opportunities to burn out along containment lines so that fire doesn't cross them, and also just patrolling to make sure that the wind is not blowing fire across the line, which we refer to as a spot fire, and if any of those are identified and taking care of those. The wind is predicted to die down pretty much through the rest of the week, which that provides more opportunity for firefighters to potentially go a little more direct at the fire, which means you're constructing lines closer to the fire's edge. You know, that equates to less burning of national forests. But it's still, you know, constructing line and burning out in order to stop the advancement of the fire's edge.
The Mendocino National Forest is very large. It's in excess of 900,000 acres. This fire has now burnt roughly 26% of the entire forest. How much of a catastrophe or issue is this for the forest unit?
Well, I mean, it's a big deal. A couple years ago, they had the Ranch Fire, which was, if not the biggest, one of the biggest wildfires in California history. And now they're dealing with the August complex, which, you know, at this point is over 240,000 acres. And so you end up with a lot of dead trees. The ground is now bare. So if you do get rain, you have the potential for, you know, sediment moving into streams. So, I mean, once the fire's out, that's really when, you know, there's a whole nother side of work that needs to begin after that. And that's really the restoration after the fire. You know, it can take months or even years to do that. Right now, we're focused on containing the fire. But once the fire is contained, then the focus shifts to rehabilitation and restoration.
Just real basically, what exactly is containment? How do you know that the fire's not going to jump some bulldozer line?
You don't know for sure. We use a number of tools to figure out how we're doing. One of those is infrared. So we get infrared images of the fire every day. That shows where the edges are hot and where they're cooling off. So that's where we know where to focus. Our idea of containment is that, you know, we have the fire not growing, not progressing forward, whether it's a dozer line, whether it's a hand line that a crew has dug, whether it's a natural feature such as a road or a creek. That the fire has essentially checked up in those areas. And to be honest, you don't want to call it contained too soon because that, you know, it provides a false sense of security for people. And then you get a wind event, it jumps the line, and then, you know, we're back to fighting fire again. So, you know, part of it is experience. The people working on these fires, they've been doing this a long time. They know when something's secure and when there's still a chance that it could rise back up again. And the other part is just not making that call too soon and just making sure that we're comfortable that it has checked up, it is cooling off, and even if there were a wind event, we don't expect it to jump the line. It's one of those art and science things as far as being able to call a fire of this size contained.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I guess the only thing I'd like to add is just, you know, one, we'd really like to thank the community for their support, and also just a shout out to the firefighters on the ground. I mean, a lot of them have come from all over the United States, left their families to come and try to fight this fire and try to protect, you know, the communities in and around the Mendocino National Forest, protect the structures, and also just try to do what's best on the ground to get the fire contained. So there's a ton of hard work going on in rugged, hot, really dry conditions, and they really are the heroes doing the work that needs to be done.
That was Jason Nedlow of the U.S. Forest Service talking with NSBR's Mark Albert. Coming up, the latest on how to vote in Butte County this fall amid the pandemic. This is special coverage from North State Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from HubSpot, whose enterprise CRM platform is designed to help marketing, sales, and customer service teams generate leads, grow sales, and to innovate the customer experience. More at HubSpot.com. Grow better. From the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, which aims to improve the quality of people's lives through grants supporting child well-being, the environment, medical research, and the performing arts. And from the listeners who support this NPR station. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Avalara, managing the sales tax compliance process with cloud-based rate and rule updates, as well as automatic return filing. More at avalara.com. Avalara, tax compliance done right. From Indeed, offering sponsored jobs and tools like screener questions to help businesses find the high-impact hires who can make a difference. Learn more at indeed.com/high-impact. From ProQuest, whose eNow programs help libraries support online studies by converting physical materials to digital, including books, journals, and music scores. ProQuest.com/go/NPR. And from Americans for the Arts.
This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Matt Fidler. With everything else going on, fires, really hot weather, and announcements about new COVID-19 outbreaks, you wouldn't be blamed for forgetting that there's an election coming up. Since it looks like so many people will be voting by mail, it's important to plan enough time to get your ballot in. Candace Grubbs is Butte County's clerk recorder and register of voters. She spoke with NSBR's Andre Bayek about voting by mail and what differences voters can expect if they decide to cast their ballot in person.
What we will have at our voter assistance centers will change drastically. We're going to be asking all voters that show up there, and we only had 3,400 in the primary, use our voter assistance centers. Most people voted by mail. They'll be asked to wear a face covering, and if they don't have one, we will have them for them. Maintain physical distancing, at least 6 feet. There'll be hand sanitizers at the check-in station. Then, you know, they'll be asked to put their own ballot into the ballot box. And again, use hand sanitizers on their way out. So our staff out at the voter assistance centers will have what we call sneeze screens, but they're, you know, the screens to keep the distance between voters and themselves. The distance is what we're really concerned about, so we're trying to organize different lines. For one thing, if you just need to drop off your voted ballot, the ballot box will be at the outside or the entrance to the voter assistance center, so you don't have to stand in line. We're just working out all of the issues of trying to get people in and out and safely, and have our staff be safe too. We certainly don't want anybody to get sick, but if you really want to be safe, vote the ballot that is sent to you in the mail.
Regarding the ballots that people should start receiving in the mail at the beginning of October, will there be any difference regarding who gets a ballot for this upcoming election than who got a ballot in the primary?
Well, the difference would be registration. We've been increasing our registration. There's been some registration drives going on, although they look different than they have in the past. I would hope that everybody would go to our website, buttevotes.net, and check their voter registration, check their address, or they can call our office at 552-3400, option 1, and staff will be glad to check their address to make sure before we mail ballots out that we're going to be mailing it to the right location. And before the March primary in 2018, most of our voters voted by mail. So people in this county have long been voting by mail. It's the same process. We did have, you know, polling locations before. Now we've gone to voter assistance centers. And the reason I changed the title instead of vote centers to voter assistance center, because you only go there if you need assistance. And you didn't get your ballot, you're registering late, or you're not registered at all. Something has happened to your ballot, you made a mistake, and you need a new one. But for the vast majority of people, they'll receive their ballot in the mail, vote the ballot, put it in the envelope, make sure that you sign the envelope, seal it. It takes no stamp to mail it back. Be sure to mail it before Election Day because you want to make sure that it is date stamped Election Day or prior. And this is one thing I would really like to train our voters on. Our mail all goes to Sacramento to be processed, and the trucks leave the different post offices at different times. So you can't walk into a post office at 8 o'clock at night and deposit your ballot and think it will have an election day, November 3rd, date stamp on it. More than likely, it'll sit there till the next day, and it'll be date stamped November 4th, and we can't count it. If you still have your ballot on election day, drop it off at any one of the drop boxes or voter assistance center, and all of those are listed online, of course, and in the voter information packet that is being sent with your ballot.
You mentioned staff safety at in-person voter assistance centers. I'm curious if the state is assisting your office with PPE or maybe other ways the state is assisting.
They are assisting with PPE, and then what they aren't, we will be purchasing. That's why I say that if voters show up with no mask, we will have masks. We'll have gloves for the staff. We will have sanitizers. And we're going to be teaching our staff protocol on how to clean the equipment. Of course, there's going to be those little dots on the floor to stand here. So everybody has their social distancing.
Regarding the Postal Service, there are some concerns that perhaps the Postal Service may experience serious delays in getting ballots back to elections offices for tabulation. Is your office preparing for a scenario in which there could be delays in receiving ballots?
We have up to 17 days after the election to receive ballots. And so I don't think there'll be any problem with getting a batch of ballots after the election. We have done this before, but we've never had that many days to receive them.
Is there any advice you'd like to drive home that perhaps I hadn't already asked you about?
I think the biggest thing right now, because we want to get ballots to the voters, and as so many of our people in this county have continued to move around as they're getting settled from the campfire, and of course with our students. Now, students have a choice. They can have their registration in Butte County or where they're currently residing at home, and if they're doing their classes online, they're, you know, living somewhere else. So they need to make sure that they are registered to vote where they want to vote.
Is there anything else I didn't ask you that perhaps you'd like to add or clarify about the upcoming election?
One thing that bothers me is that we're not teaching young people really to write anymore. And so they use a scribble mark as their signature. That's my biggest concern, is signature verification. But they'll get a letter from us, they'll get a phone call from us asking, you know, did you vote your ballot, to verify that they voted their ballot.
That was Butte County Clerk Recorder and Register of Voters Candace Grubbs speaking with NSPR's Andre Baik. You may remember a few weeks ago, after feeling ill, NSPR's Angel Hiracha decided he needed a COVID-19 test. He found it was pretty easy to make an appointment. Here's an update on how he felt while he waited and what his test result was.
That sinking feeling of anxiety is something many of us have had while waiting for any medical results. It is out of our hands. After taking my COVID-19 test, I was given a 4 to 6 day time period to expect my results. Fair, I've watched enough news to know what's going on. But the panic began eating away at me as soon as I stepped outside of the testing center. With a high number of tests and overwhelmed labs, I already expected a slower turnaround. But this didn't make waiting any easier. After my test, I rushed home only to sit with my thoughts and begin imagining the worst-case scenarios. Stories filled my head with those who've had the virus. 1 minute, it's a cough. The next, it's being kept alive on a ventilator. My thoughts were really about the safety of those around me. My partner, who I've been with for almost 8 years, my mother, and other family members. Even though they're 600 miles away, they're still the first people on my mind when I wake up in the morning. If I did have the virus, the last thing I'd want is to have them contract this disease that can potentially put them in the hospital. This is what entered my head several times a day, and continues to, days after getting my results back. The day I was tested, I got an automated phone call letting me know my test was now at the lab. There was slight comfort in knowing that. It kind of felt like grabbing the next number at your local deli counter, that I'm next feeling. The next day was like the day before, staying indoors, ordering takeout, filling my day with work. Later that day, I got a second phone call letting me know my test results would be taking a few days longer because the lab was backed up. You take a breath, remind yourself that it's just a few extra days. You aren't going anywhere. You can't. There's nothing you can do. Luckily, I'm one of the few who can work from home. I can occupy my time with my work despite the lingering thoughts of the test on my mind. On the third day, I got a third phone call letting me know my test results were still pending. I don't need extra phone calls. I barely answer the phone for friends. This isn't Tinder. I don't need you to remind me you're thinking of me. I just need my results. I was growing impatient. With the added pressures of COVID-19, it's difficult not to. There's no right way of waiting for your results. Patience is key. I will say this. I logged onto the results site so much, I beat the automated phone call that lets you know your results are ready. As I write this and you're listening to it, you might be thinking, he's being a bit dramatic. You'd be right. I was going nuts at that time. This pandemic has changed me, and I will never be the same again. Thankfully, my test results were negative.
That was Angel Hiracha recounting his experience getting his COVID-19 test results. And that's special coverage for Thursday, September 3rd. If you have thoughts or want to share your experiences with the pandemic, leave them on our message line, 433-9216, or our website, mynspr.org. This program was produced by Helen Barrington, Tess Vigland, Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Andre Baik, Angel Hiracha, and Phil Wilkie. I'm Matt Fidler. Thanks for being with us, and please join us for more special programming in 1 week.